My weekday fix? Darling, it has to be Radio Gorgeous. Dusty Springfield, bleach blonde beehive, sooty black eyes, glamorous sparkling frocks, and that voice, a white woman who can sing black. Today I'm very happy to welcome to Radio Gorgeous Karen Bartlett, author of Dusty, an intimate portrait of a musical legend. Karen is a journalist and a writer who writes for Times, The Guardian. Karen, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you.
Dusty the legend, you're here today to tell us about what was behind the makeup. It must have all started with her upbringing.
Well, I mean, it's just one of the things that's so interesting about Dusty is that both her and her brother came from this terribly ordinary seeming upbringing. You know, they grew up in Ealing, and her father was a tax accountant, and her mother was an Irish housewife. And they looked like a sort of a picture of, you know, 1940s, 1950s suburbia. And on the surface, there wasn't anything that, you know, would seem to be remarkable about them. And certainly, if you look at her photos from those days, she's a sort of overweight, short-haired, you know, wearing glasses. You know, she doesn't look like somebody who's going to transform herself suddenly at age 16 into a singing vamp. I mean, there were things about her childhood that were quite remarkable, though. So they seemed very ordinary, but her family really weren't ordinary underneath the surface. They were very sort of dramatic and tempestuous Irish family. Her father was an accountant, but really he was a frustrated musician. And her mother was a housewife who was quite unhappily married and really wished that she'd sort of stayed as being a sort of a bachelor girl and had wanted to be on the stage and a singer herself. So there were all those kind of frustrations and tensions in the family wanting to be acted out. And out of that sort of very strained and tense but also quite creative upbringing came Dusty and her brother Tom, which is just a sort of, you know, a remarkable launch pad for two careers that you never would have thought would have sort of launched two of the biggest sort of musical stars of the 1960s.
Could they play instruments?
Yes and no. I mean, Tom certainly could, and Dusty's father could as well. He was a pianist, and he really sort of brought her up listening to jazz and classical music. She played the guitar a little bit. I mean, she's quite often photographed playing the guitar, but she didn't, you know, I mean, she could play a few chords, she could play some songs, but she wasn't a sort of a trained musician, and she couldn't read music. And that was quite important later in her career, because when she was trying to communicate what she wanted to the musicians that she was working with, she found it terribly difficult to actually get across the sound and the atmosphere that she wanted.
So her first singing group was in her teens. It was called the Lana Sisters. Can you tell us about them?
Well, the Lana Sisters were, you know, one of those sort of quite typical 50s sisters act. And Dusty was quite lucky because she joined the Lana Sisters. She'd been singing with Tom in sort of nightclubs and small London clubs. But the Lana Sisters was really her first proper introduction to show business. And, you know, they were sort of seasoned performers. They could play instruments. Riz Chantal had been playing with a big band. So they knew show business, and they sort of schooled her and trained her into show business. But they did have records and they did appear on television. And so she was, you know, by the time she joined the Springfields, she knew about the music industry.
The Springfields was her brother's group. Did she ask to be in it?
Well, it was always a bit murky and mysterious what actually happened, mainly because I think the Lana Sisters were very disappointed that she'd, you know, only been with them for a year and then left. But the story goes that Tom basically turned up to one of the gigs that the Lana Sisters was playing at and said to Dusty, you know, we want to have this group and we need a girl to kind of front us and we want it to be you. And of course, she saw the potential in that and said, yeah. She was, I mean, of the Springfields, she was the one who had been on stage. She is the one who'd been on television. So she was really the one with the experience.
And did they write their own stuff and did they have hits?
But they wrote a lot of their own songs. And they were kind of that folksy, kind of folk country
kind
pop.
Kind of like Mamas and Papas sort of thing, that sort of a bit like that.
Yeah, I mean, they were very, you know, they were very, as Dusty always said, they were very cheerful. You know, they sort of had a very sort of cheerful, upbeat sound, and they were hugely, hugely popular. I mean, people forget now how popular the Springfields were. I mean, they were one of the biggest groups in the country before the Beatles came along.
She left to become solo.
Well, she always had very good musical taste. And, you know, when she was with the Lana sisters, she recognised what she was getting out of it professionally. But, you know, she didn't like those kind of songs. And I don't think she particularly liked the songs that she sang with the Springfields either. She had a very sort of clear idea about the kind of music that she wanted to sing. And she was quite, you know, trendy and sort of ahead of her time in kind of the music that she wanted to approach. And it was time for her to go solo, really, and to try and make it as a pop star rather than this kind of funny kind of crossover appeal.
What drove this ambition?
I think that's one of the sort of untapped mysteries of Dusty, really. I mean, we look at her childhood and we see her, you know, looking quite unremarkable. She certainly didn't seem particularly remarkable at school. And yet at 16, you know, she went out and she transformed herself. You know, she completely changed her look and she became a different person. And I think that's one of the most amazing things about her. And nobody can really explain what drove that. And she really wasn't able to explain it either, other than that she knew that the way she was, you know, she sort of said, I knew I wasn't going to make it.
Obviously, black music was her biggest influence.
She loved black music, but actually she loved all music. You know, Dusty would listen to all sorts of, you know, she'd listen to Spanish music, she'd sing French music. Mm. She was very into jazz. I mean, she was, you know, incredibly musical. But she did love, you know, she loved Motown. She loved that sound. And Vicky Wickham talks about how, you know, Dusty would sort of take her into London on a Saturday and they'd go to the record shops and dig up all these records that were coming in, or demos that were coming in from America. And, you know, they'd go back and just buy them all and just listen to all of them. And it was music that young sort of middle-class white girls in England weren't listening to. But she loved it. And, you know, she promoted it. Then she had a sort of one of the biggest experiences of her life when she went over and she sang at the Brooklyn Fox. And she was really singing with all those huge Motown stars, you know, Martha and the Vandellas and Smokey Robinson and all of those performers on the same bill as them, and she was the only white girl.
And was it a mixed audience or was it just black?
The Brooklyn Fox, it was put on as a series of shows basically over the hot summer holidays, and they would play show after sort of seven shows a day of an hour long, and they'd start in the morning and they'd just do them all day, and basically the audience would change, and they'd start off with kind of a young white school kids audience, and then as it progressed and got later in the evening, then, you know, more black people would come in and older people would come in. So I mean, it was a really rigorous, tough schedule, and she went over there and she was kind of, as I say, the only white performer on the bill. And then she came back from that experience, and then because she was working on Ready Steady Go as well, you know, she started to bring those performers over and promote their music. And then, of course, you know, she was asked to do the Motown Review, which was a huge thing on British television, and sort of became the sort of the face of promoting Motown here in the UK.
Apparently she was totally colourblind, which was unusual for those days.
Yes, I mean, she was colourblind and not racist in a very sort of human way rather than a political way. I mean, she just, you know, she had black friends, she loved black music. And it just seemed obvious to her that it just wasn't right.
She had her big hits, which include Son of a Preacher Man, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, I Only Want to Be of You. How famous was she at that point?
Well, it's fascinating because, I mean, I think she was absolutely, you know, the icon of that period. And yet when you read books now and when you sort of look back now, she's quite often not mentioned. I mean, obviously, the Beatles and all the boy groups and the, you know, the guy singers are always mentioned as being sort of iconic with the 60s, and really, you know, in a sense, she was right up there with them, and she was just as iconic. And certainly, I mean, you know, everybody that you talk to about other female singers of that time, they would mention her as being, you know, the preeminent one. I mean, Lulu says that in the book, you know, she just thought Dusty was better than her. And I think most of the other women singers would agree with her. I mean, it's interesting because Cilla Black actually sold more records than Dusty. But I think people recognise with Dusty that she had a voice and a musical talent that sort of went beyond being an ordinary girl singer. And the way that she sang, the type of music that she sang, I mean, she was just more talented. And she also had that look, didn't she? I mean, she had that amazing look.
I want to talk about the look. Who did she have to help her with her look?
She did a lot of it herself. I mean, you know, she literally would not set foot outside the house until she'd put on her makeup, until she looked like Dusty Springfield. And it was an enormous task. It took hours every day. And, you know, most of the people who knew her at that time, like Madeline Bell and her other friends, Vicky Wickham, would say, well, you know, you probably only need to spend an hour and you know, you'd look pretty much the same. You'd still look the same. But no, she wouldn't. She was a perfectionist. And then she'd go out and she'd go to Vidal Sassoon and she'd get her hair done, and that, which wasn't her natural colour, and it had to be set and it had to be in that particular style. So she'd spend hours at the hairdressers. She'd spend hours getting her nails done. And also, it's sort of interesting because you think of her as being so iconic and fashionable in the 60s. But as the 60s progressed, I mean, her look was not at all a 60s look, really. I mean, as you know, everyone started to wear short skirts, and she gave up on that because she didn't like her legs, and she wore those very long dresses, and so she had an awful lot of fittings for sort of quite old-fashioned style big gowns, big theatrical sort of stage gowns. So her whole day could be taken up basically looking like Dusty Springfield, and then she would go to work, and then she'd actually have to do the music part.
Perfectionist. That was one of her main character traits, wasn't it? Especially when it came to music.
Yeah, I mean, that made her so successful and was part of her undoing as well. You know, right from the beginning with her music, I mean, she took it terribly seriously. She knew exactly what she wanted. She got very frustrated when other people couldn't provide it. But she was she was harder on herself than she was on the musicians. I mean, she absolutely, you know, would do take after take, hour after hour, until it was right. And right from the start, you know, she had that habit where she'd sing a word at a time, you know, a syllable at a time. Everybody who sang with her would say, well, we've never seen anybody do that before. You know, they were completely flabbergasted.
Did she hang out with the Beatles, the Stones? Was she part of the groovy scene?
I don't think she was. I mean, obviously she knew all of those people. But Vicky Wickham, who very much was part of that scene, Mike Hirst from the Springfields, who was. I mean, they went to, you know, the big 60s parties every night. They went to all the clubs every night. And, you know, she wasn't there. She wasn't part of that scene. If there was somebody that she wanted to meet, she'd get ready and she'd go along and she'd meet them. And she was very sociable. She wasn't kind of a recluse or antisocial, but she wasn't at all interested in sort of hanging out in that world. Yeah. You know, she'd be at home kind of doing her knitting.
So she is a 50s girl at heart then, would you say?
Yeah.
You start off by, I mean, in the back of the book it says she was bisexual. Obviously she ended up being a lesbian in the end.
Well, that was quite interesting because people did talk about this more in this book. You know, it was always something that she never really talked about. She didn't even really talk to her friends about it. You know, she never sat down and said, well, you know, this is how it all happened. But she did talk to her partner, Sue Cameron, about it. And she said that she'd started to have these feelings when she was quite a young girl, and that she'd sort of developed this crush on the girl who lived across the road in Kent Gardens in Ealing. And she'd had a massive crush on her, and then she'd had a big crush on one of the nuns at school. And so it had sort of progressed from there. And she said she was bisexual, but, you know, to all intents and purposes, she really wasn't. I mean, she never had a boyfriend, and she never had a man, somebody that she had emotional feelings about.
So have you traced back, I mean, you've heard about the things at school. What was her first relationship as an adult then, do you know?
Well, as far as we know, or as far as she sort of told her partners, her first relationship was with another woman singer. And they were performing together at the Brooklyn Fox.
So it was a black woman?
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, they sort of, this woman took her out and they went to a club afterwards and they had something to drink and something happened, and that sort of, you know, things went from there, really.
Lovely, really nice. I know that she admitted in the press that, why did she do it? Because it really could, I mean, just think, Boy George in the 80s didn't admit it. I mean, no one admitted they were gay.
Well, that was her sort of her famous interview that she did in 1970 with Ray Connolly at the Evening Standard. It's curious, really, because there'd been so many rumours written about it in the press. I think that also she was getting to the stage where she felt as if she was ready to move on from her career in England. She was thinking about going to America. I think she thought, actually, you know, it's not such a big deal and I'm kind of sick of this and I'm going to kind of talk about it in this interview. You know, as he says, she kind of pushed him into it. I mean, he had absolutely no intention of asking her about it. And he was a bit horrified when she told him because, as a journalist, you know, he didn't know how he was going to write about it. But she was determined to sort of to get it out there. And she did this interview.
Did she use the word lesbian? What did she say?
I mean, what she says is that she has feelings for both men and women. She can be swayed both ways. But she doesn't want people to think that she's a big butch lesbian. So kind of all of her conflicting feelings, which she had forever in her life, are in that interview, really.
Was she disillusioned with England? Why did she go live in America?
And she loved the idea of America. And, you know, when she went there for her first, that first trip, when she went to Nashville and she went to New York for the first time, and she's like, wow, this is amazing. So I think she was always, at some stage, she was always going to want to go there for that reason. And I think that Dusty, in terms of her career, she felt like she'd been a huge star. She'd done all the music she wanted to do, and she was playing the same sort of circuits of northern clubs and all of those kinds of things. And she thought, well, where am I going with all of this? You know, what am I going to do for the next stage of my career? I mean, was she going to kind of go down the route of doing pantos and being a cabaret singer and all of that kind of thing?
She arrived. Where did she live? And did she still have that strong image? And how did that go down there?
Her managers put her into basically singing hotel clubs, really. And she went around and she was kind of singing to sort of middle-aged people in places like Cleveland, and, you know, she'd have to, like, turn up on the stage by going through the hotel kitchen. And she could have made an awful lot of money if she'd wanted to do that, but obviously...
Cabaret, really.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. She didn't want to do that at all.
So what went wrong? I know she ended up in drink and drugs and destructive relationships. Can you tell us about the dark period?
I think it was a combination of things going wrong professionally and things going wrong personally. Professionally, like you say, it was a strange time in music. I mean, music was really changing, and she made an album called Cameo, but it just bombed. It didn't work at all. Then she made another album, which, if you listen to it, I mean, it was potentially such an amazing album. That would have been a fantastically successful album, but she was just in such a state of crisis, she couldn't finish it. And that was sort of 1974-ish, and after that she didn't record for quite a long time. It was the culmination of all of her mental health problems, really, that had started in the 60s in London. You know, later she was diagnosed as having bipolar disorder. And in the 60s, they knew that she had some kind of depression. She, you know, she was a perfectionist. She would become quite hysterical. She wasn't taking drugs, but she was taking pills. She was taking Mandrax, which reacted really badly with her bipolar disorder. And it would, you know, send her into this almost psychotic state. She's also started to drink a lot. And when she drank, she became very out of control. And so she was already having all of those problems. She was cutting herself. She was doing all of those things in London before she went to America. Her mental health problems were never really probably diagnosed. She didn't help, to be honest. I mean, she liked to sort of feel like she was sort of fooling the psychiatrists and things, but she wasn't getting the help that she needed. And so...
So was she running out of money?
She did run out of money, yes. I mean, you know, as the 70s wore on, and certainly into the early 80s, I mean, by the early 80s, she was pretty much flat broke. You know, she'd had a period where she'd been taking cocaine, and that had kind of drained all her money. Her royalties weren't coming in from the UK in the way that they had been. You know, she wasn't getting recording contracts.
Down and out was she, yeah.
You know, there's a story with Tedder, who was her girlfriend, who quite famously had a had that fight with her and knocked her teeth out. And that story's been told before. But I talked to Tedder for this book, and she sort of tells a bit more of a complicated story about what it was like living with Dusty in those times. And one of the stories was, you know, how broke they were in terms of they'd got some eggs to make Thanksgiving dinner, and they'd had a fight in the car park, and they'd thrown the eggs at each other, and they didn't have enough money to buy any more eggs.
So how did she make money?
Well, of course, there's a quite famous story where in the 80s she ended up sort of miming to her songs in sort of West Hollywood gay bars, and she'd get paid, you know, $500 a time, and that would sort of tide her over. She didn't do that very much.
And then she got married to a very interesting-sounding woman, I must say. She seemed quite wild.
Exactly. I think they were both wild. I think it's fair to say they were both pretty wild, and they were both pretty destructive, especially when they were drinking. You know, Dusty had been quite destructive in her other relationships as well, and she sort of carried that over. By that stage, she was drawn to those sort of people. The fact that they were both very volatile, you know, it was a mixture of those things. And so, you know, they did fight, and they did sort of hit each other, and it did sort of get physical at times, and it was all quite crazy, I think, sometimes.
But she said she laughed more with her than anybody else.
She did, and I think, you know, despite everything else, she genuinely had quite strong feelings for Tedder.
So they got married. She wore a white gown.
Yeah, I mean, there's that fantastic... I mean, there was this side of Dusty that, on one hand, she was quite... She wanted to be quite middle class, she wanted to be quite respectable, and on the other side, she wanted to be outrageous.
So that's a performing side, isn't it, coming out?
That was, and she decided that she wanted to get married to Tedder, and it was her idea, and she was the one who set it all up. And she went out with this other woman who's a friend of hers, Tara, who's also in the book, and said, let's buy a wedding dress. And they went off to this shop in Hollywood and bought this, I think, secondhand white.
It's really frothy white and big. Lacy. We'll put it on the website.
White lacy wedding dress. And those photos became quite infamous later on when they sort of appeared, I think, in the Daily Mail after she died.
She loved her cats. Did they give her stability?
She did love her cats. And I think one person in the book said, you know, that really the only people she really loved, the only things she really trusted were her cats. And it's interesting because a lot of people sort of speculate about whether or not she would have wanted to have children. There are a couple of people in the 60s that say that she did want to have children. I think Vicky Wickham, though, who was her friend all of that time, said, you know, absolutely not, no, really, no. To be honest.
He's a bit mean on the child. Even though it might have settled her down, you see.
But I think that's one of the interesting things is that, you know, you think that she was wild and sort of quite out of control for a lot of her life. And yet, you know, she was always absolutely responsible about looking after her cats. She never neglected them. She always fed them. She always looked after them. I mean, she was absolutely the most responsible mother of those cats you could imagine.
Everything to do with relationships is where she had the problem, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, and I think that's when she came back to England, she didn't really have any more relationships. I mean, she just knew that was crazy and she couldn't do it. And it just led to her downfall all the time.
So did she kind of run away then back to England?
She had a revival with the Pet Shop Boys.
Yes.
There were a couple of songs. There was the song from Scandal and then the sort of the In Private. She was actually quite reluctant to do them. I mean, she always told the story that this had kind of fallen on her lap and she'd immediately said yes and rushed back to do it. The woman who wrote those songs said, you know, that's not how it was, that she'd been basically trying to persuade Dusty to do them for about 3 years.
I bet she was nervous as hell, yeah.
I mean, she turned down so many great songs in the 70s. You know, she turned down Killing Me Softly, she turned down a Bond theme. I mean, there were so many. She turned down a lot of songs and she probably should have left a long time before she did.
So what year was it that she came back?
And she got back here in about 1989.
So the Pet Shop Boys, suddenly were people interested in her career? Were people buying her records? Did she perform again?
Absolutely. I mean, that was her. She'd always tried to make records, always tried to have comebacks, but that was really her big revival. And then, you know, at the same time, they put out a huge kind of a silver disc of all her songs, and it was suddenly very cool to be Dusty again. She came back and she went and she lived in the countryside.
Which is probably good for her.
And she needed that. She needed to be calm and tranquil, and she had her cats and she didn't have crazy relationships. You know, people who knew her in the 60s were just delighted because they felt like they'd got the old Dusty back.
The big C came. How old was she?
She was 54 and she'd been recording her last album back in Tennessee. In Nashville, where she'd sort of started off all those years ago with the Springfields, and she hadn't been well, and she'd been, you know, I mean, she, as I say, recording with Dusty could often take a long time and be quite difficult, but it was, something was different about it, you know, and she had a sore throat, and she came back to this country after she'd finished recording and realised that she had a lump in her breast. And sort of things moved quite quickly at that point, and she was diagnosed as having breast cancer. By then was quite advanced. The cancer came back, and of course when it came back it was terminal. I think it when they realised it came back in her bones.
So how old was she actually when she died?
She was 59, but she was only a few weeks from her 60th birthday. Although she said she never wanted to be 60, so...
Wow, yeah, careful what you say. Follow us on Twitter, radio_gorgeous. Lots of love, darlings. Mwah.
Preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along. When they gathered round and started talking, Pastor Billy would take me walking. Out through the backyard we go walking. Then he'd look into my eyes. Lord knows, to my surprise, the only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was. Yes, he was. Being good isn't always easy, no matter how hard I try. When he started sweet talking to me, he'd come and tell me everything is alright. He'd kiss and tell me everything is alright. Can I get away again tonight? The only one who could ever reach me.
tell me what legacy she's left musically then?
She could sing anything. I mean, she was a soul singer. She was a great ballad singer. She sort of brought in all those other sort of influences, like influences from Motown and black music into her, that style and that interpretation. I mean, it's definitely, you know, you can hear echoes of it in Amy Winehouse and in Adele, and, you know, I mean, very different singers. I mean, Adele is a completely different style of singer to Dusty, but, you know, there's something about that interpretation and that legacy that, you know, you can hear today that definitely traces back to Dusty. I think it's interesting because I think she's in some way more a person of here and now than she was of her time. I mean, she's this 60s icon, but actually we understand her much better today than we did then. And I think that's why there's also such a sort of revival of interest in her, and that we get, you know, we get all her sort of mixed up feelings about her relationships and her sexuality and her problems with addiction. And so I think in some ways she's a very sort of modern contemporary person. And I think that's why there is now this interest in her and musicals and films and things about her for that reason. So I think there's that side to it. On the other hand, you know, she was a great artist and a great diva. And so however many correct diagnoses you could give her for her mental problems, however much you could help her with her addictions, she had that side to her personality, and that was part of what made her fantastic musically. So I don't think if she was a young artist today, she'd be sort of having an easy time of it. I think all of that sort of perfectionism and angst and drama that she thrived on would still be there. I mean, that was part of what made her so great as well.
Dusty, An Intimate Portrait of a Musical Legend by Karen Bartlett is published by Robson Press. Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
Thanks, it was great.
Wasn't me who changed, but you. And now you've gone away. Don't you see that now you've gone, and I'm left here on my own, that I have to follow you.
Gorgeous. Listen anywhere, anytime.